If you've ever been a part of a church or have gone to church at some point, I'm sure you've heard the word sin, right? Sin is this big, scary thing that if you do this thing called sin, whatever that list is on that list, whatever is on that list, it'll be the thing that makes you go to hell. And that's scary and you shouldn't do it. And so you got to stop sinning, right? But what if, hear me out, there was a better way to understand the concept of sin. What if we need to do a better job of talking about what sin is? Well, today on Whiskey in the Writings, I'm going to share with you maybe a different way to think about sin, one that may actually help you live the life God has always intended you to live. So pour your drink. We're going to have some whiskey and the writings. All right, here we are. Thank you for joining us. I've got my glass, a little bit of ice inside of it, because today I'm drinking some Pendleton rye. This is the 12-year Pendleton rye, 1910. I usually like the Pendleton Midnight. This is a Canadian whiskey, and so it's a little bit different, but I usually like the Midnight. But I bought the 1910 because my dad really loves the 1910. And so anytime I drink a Pendleton whiskey, I think of him because he really likes it. He usually gets, I think it's the 9-year. I opted for the 12-year. So we're going to pour a little bit of that today. That's what I'm drinking. I don't know what you're drinking, but go ahead and pour a little bit in your sipping cup. And we are going to have a conversation today. So, like in our introduction, I brought up the concept of sin, and we're going to look at maybe a better way to think about sin. And if you're interested in a little bit more on this concept, I've written a 3-part series on what sin is and really rethinking about it. And I called it Becoming a Monster. And we're going to explore a little bit today on Whiskey and the Writings, what that means, what that looks like, and how that relates to biblical sin. And so we're going to start out really by looking at what is sin? And the way that we think about sin. My tradition that I grew up in, sin was this thing to avoid, right? So you shouldn't do this thing called sin. And if you did that, you were at risk. And the risk was that you would not go to heaven, right? So I remember a popular phrase that was used when I was an early Christian was, if you were to die today, where would you go? And if you were someone that couldn't answer that question or lived a particularly bad life, the answer to that question was hell. I don't want to go to hell. And so then prompted the response by the person that would ask that question, like, you know, do you need to trust in Jesus, or you should? What do you need to repent of? Like, what do you need to ask for forgiveness of because of the sin in your life? And so as I became a Christian and I began to explore this life of Christianity, more and more the conversation about my sin became prominent in my life. And my sins could be multiple things. It could be lying. It could be like, you know, looking at things I shouldn't be looking at. It could be using language that was inappropriate. It could be disobeying my parents. It could be just like, it was this list. And what had happened, and I think this happens to a lot of people, what had happened to me was that I moved into a space of what you might call sin management, right? Where it was this idea that I had that my goal in life was to avoid all the sinful things, which was usually a list defined by my church as what was important for that time, right? When I was a teenager, it was like listening to secular music. And so we would have these things where, and this might be silly to some of you in the audience, but for some of you that are of my generation, like a Christian in the early 90s, mid 90s, Throwing away secular music was a big thing, right? You had to get rid of your secular music. And so we would like throw them away. And then, you know, 3 months later, we would buy back those CDs. And it was just this kind of cyclical kind of life that you lived. And you only bought Christian music and only listened to Christian music. And so because those other things that you were listening to were bad influences on you and cause you to sin, right? And the whole concept, at least in my evangelical Pentecostal upbringing, was like how to not get caught sinning, because if I got in a place where the Lord would return, Jesus would return, or I would die, I was at jeopardy of not being able to be with them anymore. Not a good look. And but that was sin for me. And whatever your faith tradition might be as you're tuning in, the reality is that we've done a poor job, I think, of talking about sin. And it's popular nowadays to actually not talk about it at all, to really just focus on like the goodness of Jesus and the goodness of what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Kind of like there's a movement towards that where we don't talk about sin. And here's the thing, the Bible does talk about it, right? So we've got to explore this idea and concept, and we're going to do that here in this video. But what I'm getting at here is that simply, I think we just need to do a better job of talking about it. We need to develop new language to understand this idea of what sin is. And every generation of Christianity does this. And so here's going to be one of the hardest things that you're going to discover as you continue to watch videos with me at Whiskey in the Writings, is that I have no problem developing new thought and language when it comes to exploring concepts in the Bible. We tend to do these things where we sit within certain genres of teachings, and we make those genres of teachings the be-all and end-all of what it means to be a Christian. Take, for example, there's a whole movement called Lutheranism, right? To be Lutheran. And I'm not knocking on Lutherans. Like one of my best friends was a Lutheran minister. I have many Lutheran friends of mine that minister to me and speak into my life. That's not a bad thing. I'm just saying, like, the whole movement is based off of one guy's point of view. You know, Luther and kind of what became known as the Protestant Reformation. You have Calvinists, right, who was a, not at the time of Luther, but came kind of after him. You have Calvinists and people that tend to like move into certain genres of thought based off of one particular person's point of view at a particular time in history. And my aim is to say, I actually think that every generation should reinterpret Scripture as for what it means for them. Because here's the thing about the Bible. What makes the Bible be evergreen, meaning that it's lasted as long as it has, is that it has an ability to speak wisdom into our lives in any generation at any time in history. And it has done that and continues to do that throughout history. So the real question is that if we're going to tackle this concept of sin, what is the wisdom that I need to heed in my life, in my generation, and at my time that will be the most beneficial to understand how to think and talk about this concept of sin? So if you're still with me, that's what we're gonna do. If you've tuned me out already, check the next one. But what we're gonna do is we're gonna talk about sin. And we're not gonna talk about sin in the black and white. We're not gonna talk about sin through the lens of like, here are the list of things to do and not do. As I say that, though, you need to understand that the Bible does give us things that we should do and should not do. Okay, so this isn't to say that it's like this kind of lackadaisical kind of point of view on sin. The Bible, writers like Paul, and when I say the Bible, I mean like you get the Levitical law, you get people like Paul, you get people like Peter, who are writing to people at specific times, trying to help them understand what it means to be faithful to the God Yahweh, and also to Jesus as he became God in flesh to us to show us the way. There are things that we should do and shouldn't do. But there's a greater way of thinking about this. And here's how I've learned to talk about sin. Sin is the thing. And so I have my article up here, and I have a quote in my article here. And you can find this on storiesoftove.com. And I'll link to that in the show notes. It's our parent company of Whiskey and the Writings, where I house a lot of writings that I do that I encourage you to check out. But in this, I call it Becoming a Monster Part One. This is how I define sin. Okay, this is Joe Oliver's definition of sin. The definition of sin is this: sin is the thing that is, it's a thing that, if left unchecked, meaning if I just let this thing go in my life, it will ultimately lead to my dehumanization. Okay? Sin is the thing that, if left unchecked, will lead to your dehumanization. What do I mean by that? Okay, so it all begins in Genesis, which I believe is like the framework. Genesis 1 and 2 is the framework of the entire Bible. If you can understand Genesis 1 and 2, you will understand the major meta themes that are running all throughout the Bible, which is all about identity and vocation in the creational good. And so in Genesis, we get this picture of what it means for things to be good. And particularly, and you'll see this if you saw my part one, part two and three of the previous two videos on Genesis 1 particularly. And I encourage you to go check those out. But there's a certain point in the creation where God does something different. So up until this point in creation, he's been creating these spaces, and then he's been filling those spaces. Again, if those terms are unfamiliar to you, go check out that other video. I'll link to it as well so you can find it quickly. But here's the point, is that he gets to day six, and after he creates the animals that go on the land, he creates a different kind of animal. This kind of animal is distinctly different than all the other animals that he has created. And the distinction is in its identification, which is this. It says in verse 27, Genesis chapter 1, 27, God created humankind, humans, humanity. If you're reading out of like the ESV Bible, you're going to get the word God created man. That word is Adam, or more particularly in the Hebrew, it's Ha'adam, which literally means humans or humanity or humankind. And so although the word is Adam or Ha'adam, which can be translated man, and I'm getting in the weeds, and listen, this is what I love about Whiskey in the Writings. I'm going to get in the weeds with y'all, all right? So just, you got to bear with me here, because if you're looking for something simple, I'm not going to give you simple. If you were to take Adam and translate it to an English equivalent, it does mean man. But it does not mean man as a singular human male, okay? Because it is supplied with, right before it, at Ha'adam. The Ha'adam gives the clarification of what kind of man we're talking about. And so when I say to a group of people that have a mixed gender in the room, and I might go, "What's up, dudes?" Okay, so I just dated myself there, right? Nobody says that anymore, and I get that. 90s, whatever. But if I were to do that, I don't mean that I'm only talking to the men, the dudes in the room, the males in the room. I'm talking about everyone. It's a generalization of a term to say the people in the room. It's like saying, "Hey, guys," right? And we say that a lot. We say, "Hey, guys." Now, when we say that, that doesn't mean to... That we just simply mean males that we're addressing. We say, "Hey, guys," means the people in the room. And it's the same here in Genesis 1. When you read that God created humankind, this is the NET version that I'm reading there. And if you want to buy an NET version of the Bible, it is wonderful. I'll link to it as well. You can check it out. But the point is that it's talking about humankind, the humans, which means it's plural. It is male and female. How do we know it's male and female? Well, luckily for us, the author clarifies. So it says this, verse 27, God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, right? Plural, not singular. Male and female, he created them. So the author is very explicit here in that on day six, God creates humankind, which is male and female. It's a general statement about what God created, okay? This is not about specific ordering of creation, which sometimes people want to read into this as if God created the man and then he created the female. And if you have questions about, well, what about Genesis 2? We can get to Genesis 2 in a future video. For now, what is the point? The point for Genesis 1 is to say that God created humans, okay? We are distinctly made as a human. We are not a dog. We are not a cow. We are not a bird. We are not a fish. We are not a plant. We are not the ground. We are not the fruit. We are not anything but humans. And this is the way God wanted it. God created humans. You are a human being. That is your creational good. That is what you're meant to be, a human being. So when I say sin is the thing that if left unchecked will result in our dehumanization, what I mean to say is that sin is this concept that if it continues in my life, I will no longer be a human. Sin moves me further and further and further away from the creational good of being a human. So Genesis 1 sets the stage of what we're meant to be. Our identity, our whole purpose is about being a human. God didn't want us to be anything other than a human. And so when we look at the idea of sin, we have to start at what God wanted us to be. And who gets to define what it is to be a human? Well, if you're following the trajectory of the biblical narrative, it's God. It's like this. If I created the hammer, I can sit here. If I created a hammer, and I wanted that hammer to drive nails into material. And someone comes along and says, no, that hammer is actually a screwdriver. And we're going to use it to twist in screws into material. I, as the owner or the creator of the hammer, I get to kind of go, no, that's actually not what I made it to do. Like, I made it, I get to define what it is and what its purpose is. That's Genesis 1 and 2. All over the map, the whole point of Genesis 1 and 2 is to tell you who you are and what you're here for. It's the most primal two questions in all of human existence. Who am I? My identity. Why am I here? Genesis 1 and 2 jumps out of the pages going, this is who you are, this is what you're here to do. And the first thing, who you are, God says you are a human, and he gets to define what that human being looks like, what they do, how they do it, and what role that they play within all of the things that he created. And so, when we move outside of that definition, let's go back to the analogy. If I make a hammer, And I say that the purpose of that hammer is to drive in a nail into a material, you know, and it's to do that. And someone comes along and goes, well, I'm actually going to use it to twist a screw in. They are actually now using that hammer for a different purpose than it was intended to do. The question might be philosophically, is it then still a hammer? No. because you're using it as a screwdriver, it now becomes a screwdriver. And if the creator of that object, the hammer, says that's not what I created it to do, anything that's used outside of what the creator's intent was now makes it something different. And here's my whole argument for sin. Sin isn't simply a laundry list of things to do and not do. Sin is the thing that when you, what you do is something that is non-human based off of the definition of what God says a human is. So here's a good example. If God says that humans should be people of generosity, then the times in my life that I am not generous, and what does generosity look like? It's not just financial. It's with my time. It's with my patience. It's with my, you know, my effort. If I'm not being generous, and God says to be a human is to be someone who is generous, who gives, who sacrifices for others. When I'm not that, I am not human. And if I let that behavior linger long enough in my life, I will no longer be recognized as a human, because I have participated in a behavior for so long that I am no longer now the thing recognized as a human. I'm something other. I'm something different. Okay, so here's a biblical example. So we're going to turn to Daniel. If you have your Bibles, we're going to turn to Daniel. Daniel is in the Old Testament. If you're following along, there we go. Here's Daniel. And we're going to look at Daniel chapter 3, I believe. Let me find it here. Chapter 3. Nope, that's Daniel's friends are tested. Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4. Yep. Okay. So, in Daniel chapter 4, you have a guy named Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar is the king of an empire called Babylon at this time. And Babylon had conquered Jerusalem. So in the biblical narrative, Babylon is this big empire. So if you're following history, you have the Assyrians. The Assyrians were the powerhouse of the ancient world. Then the Babylonians took over from the Assyrians, conquered the Assyrians. They became the major powerhouse. And then the Persians took over after the Babylonians, and they became the major powerhouse. And then it was the Greeks, and then it was the Romans. And so kind of the trajectory of course of history. And in that saga, that storyline, Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian, Greek, Roman, you have this thread narrative of the Israelites. And that's what the Bible is telling you, that thread narrative of the Israelites. It's this marginalized people group. We think of the Israelites in the Bible as like this powerhouse, and they were not, okay? They were nowhere near a powerhouse in the ancient world. They were just conquered and conquered and conquered and conquered. And so their story emerges out of that being conquered. And you have this story in the writings of Daniel. Daniel and his friends were elites in Israel, in Judah. And when Babylon conquered Judah, they had taken the best of Israel, and they exported them to Babylon. Well, actually, Israel here, and they go off to Babylon, and they live there. And so the writing of Daniel is all through the lens of this exile. They're in Babylon trying to be faithful to Yahweh, but being incorporated into Babylonian culture. And the main baddie in this story is Nebuchadnezzar. He's the king of Babylon who conquered Judah and took over Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, and exported the people. And so you have this king, and he's having all these dreams, and Daniel's a part of interpreting these dreams. And you have this very interesting story about Nebuchadnezzar and his his understanding of himself. And this is what he says. So in verse 28. This is chapter 4 and verse 28. It says this. Now all this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. After 12 months, he happened to be walking around on the battlements of the royal palace of Babylon. So here's the stage. He's walking around, he's hanging out in Babylon. He's walking around his palace. The king uttered these words. So this is what he says about himself. Is this not the great Babylon that I have built for a royal residence by my own mighty strength and for my majestic honor? So we read this, and this king here, he's looking around Babylon, he's overseeing the city, and he's going, look what I did. I built all of this by my power and by my might. And so we might go, well, that's what's the problem with that? Here's the underlying undercurrent, okay? These statements of I did this are the undercurrents of Genesis chapter 3, where it's all about people, the humans, who see what they think is good and they take for themselves, okay? This is Genesis 3 language. So Nebuchadnezzar is tapping into the undercurrent of human existence, which is to say, by my strength and by my power, in and without a God that is in there working and moving. And so then it goes like this. This is crazy. Verse 31. It's crazy. He just gets done saying this. While these words were still on the king's lips, he's just speaking them out. A voice came down from heaven. So he hears a voice. It is hereby announced to you, King Nebuchadnezzar, that your kingdom has been removed from you. You will be driven from human society, and you will live with the wild animals. You will be fed grass like oxen, and 7 periods of time will pass by you. For before you, understand that the Most High is the ruler over human kingdoms, and gives them to whoever he wishes. So right here, he's uttering these words, look what I did, I'm so great. And then a voice comes down and says, actually, you're wrong. It is God who gives, and it is God who takes away. And in this moment, you're gonna see a God who takes away. So this is what happens next. It says this, verse 33. Now, in that very moment, this pronouncement about Nebuchadnezzar came true. He was driven from human society. He ate grass like oxen, and his body became damp with the dew of the sky, until his hair became long like eagle's feathers, and his nails like birds' claws. So, what are we seeing here? Nebuchadnezzar makes a proclamation about himself that's independent of the creator God's involvement. An angel shows up and says, actually, you're wrong. And after that moment, what happens to Nebuchadnezzar, he's driven from human society. So he's no longer with those who are like him, humans. And then it begins to describe the status of his being. He grows long hair and long fingernails. Now he's eating like the grass of the field. It's depicting him as an animal. Do you see that? He grows hair that looks like the eagle's, you know, feathers. Like the example here is so clear that when we reject God and begin to say that we are in control, we begin to move from the thing that God originally wanted us to be, humans. When we define for ourselves what is good and what is bad, we slowly begin the trajectory of becoming no longer the thing we were created to be, which is humans. We were meant and created to be human. And God gets to define what that looks like. And so the task for us is to go, how do I become more human, not less human? And here's the key in this story. I love this. So you get this story about what he turns into when he rejects God. And I love this. Verse 34, Daniel chapter 4. But at the end of the appointed time, I, Nebuchadnezzar. So here's the thing, right? We're reading a writing called Daniel, whom Daniel probably influenced, or a scribe of Daniel wrote these things down. But at this point in time, it becomes first person. Do you see that? Right in the middle of Daniel chapter 4, you have a first person statement, which might ask the question, who is writing? Because he says, at the end of the appointed time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, looked up towards the heaven, and my sanity returned to me. Is Nebuchadnezzar writing this? Do we have an account of a Babylonian king that's been inserted into a text of Daniel? A first-hand declaration? I, at that point in time, it's like he's saying, guys, you need to understand, I was an animal. And then I recognized and I looked up to the heavens. And when I turned towards God, all of my humanity, my sanity was restored to me. This is the picture. This is the gospel. This is the good news, is that when we look up, when you are in your darkest moment, when you are in a place where you feel like life is falling apart and you are no longer, you don't even understand what your point in life is, and you may be looking like I shouldn't even continue on because nothing's working. And Nebuchadnezzar was at the lowest place of his life and he just looked up. It doesn't say he prayed a prayer. It doesn't say that he did a reflection of all his bad things. It just simply means he turned to God. And wherever you're at right now, you can turn to God. You can look up and God is right there. God is right there. Now, for those of you that may be asking the question, Joe, you keep saying God gets to define. So how do we know what God defines and doesn't define, right? That's the big debate in church circles, isn't it? Who gets to define, right? What is the thing to do, to not do? Here's the simplicity of it all. It's Jesus. Jesus gets to define what it means to be human. If we are to look at the trajectory of Scripture, here's what we're going to see. We're going to see a God who makes everything good. Chapter 3, we're going to see humans choose their own way. We're going to see then the outworking of when humans choose their own way and how it never works out well. And yet we're going to see a God in chapter 12 of Genesis that steps into humanity, chooses a human and says, I'm going to work through you and I'm going to work through your family and I'm going to show the rest of the world what it looks like to do the human thing right, to continue and carry on the good work that I started in Genesis 1 and 2. And the question is, as we explore that story all through the rest of the Old Testament, the question we might ask is, do they do it or don't they do it? And time and time again, we see moments where they're doing that well, and we see moments where they're not doing that well at all, right? We look at the main characters all throughout, the people that God chooses to work with. Are they a good guy or are they a bad guy? And it's a mixed bag every single time. And so you go through the course of human history where the people that God chose to be the representation of what it means to show the good of creation, they continue to fall short. It's not that they're evil. They're not the bad guys. They were the people that God chose and they weren't perfect at it. And then it's as if in a pinnacle moment of history, God finally decides to say, you know what? I'm just going to come down and show them myself and or Jesus. Jesus enters the scene. And then the Gospels are all about recording what this rabbi said to them about how to be human. And they preserve the stories and the sayings of Jesus so that we today can reflect on those things and ask of ourselves, am I being human? Which a better question might be, am I being like Jesus? This is what we're about. This is what it means to be the thing that God created us to be. If you're to be the hammer, in our silly analogy at the beginning, you have to ask, is there a hammer example I can look at to show me what it means to be a hammer? Can I see a scenario where a hammer is being used properly? And can I see an example of when a hammer is being used improperly? And the answer is yes. Yes. In Jesus, you see it being used perfectly. And then you see in other examples like the Old Testament, these leaders where you see sometimes they're being a hammer well and sometimes they're not being a hammer well. The point is that we look to Jesus. And so if you are wondering, how do I do this? And you're going, Joe, tell me what it looks like to be a human well. I'm just going to tell you, read the Gospels. Well, Joe, I've read it before. And I said, read it again. Read it again and again and again and again. Until you infuse yourself with Jesus, you'll never be able to understand what it means to live for Jesus. Here's the thing. When we look at Paul, sometimes we in Protestant movements, we tend to just focus all on Paul. Like Paul defined, he led the church, he gave us all the script of how to do this. Here's the thing. This is what made Paul so effective is that he spent 3 years with Jesus. Well, you say, well, what do you mean? Paul came after Jesus. Here's the thing about Paul. When Paul had his conversion experience, he went to the desert for 3 years. He spent 3 years in the desert by himself, and then he presented himself to the apostles for their approval and their stamp of approval to say he's good to go. How would they stamp their approval on him had he not spent time with Jesus? I am certain that James and Peter sat down with Paul and said, hey, what are you doing here? And Paul probably said something like, well, when I spent time with Jesus over the course of these 3 years, this is what he told me. And they probably went, yeah, that's what he told us too, right? So when you look at Paul, all of his writings come through the lens of someone who had spent 3 years with him. How long did the apostles, the disciples spend with Jesus? 3 years. Here's the point, guys. Spend time with Jesus. That is the best way to learn what it means to be human. And once you understand Jesus, then you can actually go back and reread Paul and understand him for what he meant to say, not what we're trying to make him say. Guys, that's another video for another day. And I'm getting fired up because I love this stuff. Guys, this is so important. You can be like Nebuchadnezzar. You can become an animal, but God invites you to become a human. Genesis chapter 1 is about you being a human. You don't have to be an animal. You don't have to act like an animal. Sin is the thing that moves you away from being a human. It's not so much about the list of things to do as it is about a mindset of the things of what you should do in the sense of being a human versus what you shouldn't do and the things that take you away from not being a human. We can talk more and more about this. My encouragement to you is this. Go to storiesoftove.com, check out these articles, comment. Tell me a little bit more about what you're thinking. These are just, maybe this might be the first time you've ever heard a thought like this. I would love to engage with you more about it. But for now, that's all the time we have. I'm on my last few sips of whiskey. And I want to encourage you to like and subscribe, comment at the bottom, let us know what you're thinking, but it'll really help the channel out. I'm not really a YouTuber, but that's what I know you got to do. So if this channel is meaningful to you, please like, please pass it along, please subscribe, and let us know what you think in the comments below. And hope you enjoy your night. Until next time on Whiskey in the Writings, cheers, and hopefully you got some things to think about.